Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, I hope you're happy. I tried to close 2017-18 on a real promising, uplifting, you know, feelings ball type of note. You know, a giant group hug for the entire world. And 2018 gets off to a start that I'm blaming 100% on you, and it's because not that long ago, you were openly speculating about what might happen if James Harden got injured. You were doing this thing where he just seems due, and it's just so below the belt. It's so uncalled for as a professional media member to ever risk harm on a professional athlete. And lo and behold, what do we have here? A very tough week for James Harden that culminates with a hamstring injury that's got him sidelined for multiple weeks. I really hope you're happy. Just despicable.
Look, man, I'm not going to let you pin this on me. And honestly, I'm glad you brought up the Rockets because you always start these pods with these meandering monologues that go in 100 different directions and throw me off balance. I think today I need to jump in at the top because we have to address something. A few weeks ago, listeners may remember that you came on this podcast and announced to all the listeners that, in your words, my basketball world was crumbling. And you mentioned you mentioned that KD was shining. My guy Steph Curry was hurt. The Wizards were a mess. James Harden was on top of the world. And that same week, we got a lot of feedback from emailers and people on Twitter shocked at how ruthless you were. I mean, our own Lee Jenkins came on the podcast and said he was just hoping to avoid the Sharp treatment. Now,
well, they weren't shocked how ruthless I was. They were just amazed that I would verbalize it so directly because everybody knew it was true.
They were all thinking it. Sure, whatever you need to tell yourself. But look, what's important here, and it's where we have to start. I would be remiss if I didn't point out that since that podcast, your world has crumbled, and it's now clear that, like always, I was right about everything. And there are a number of things happening at once here. It's like a perfect storm of Golliver L's. So let me just go through the list, and then we'll get to the questions. But number one, Michigan football. Your one true love, your passion. I didn't watch the Outback Bowl, but if you'd asked me a couple days ago whether South Carolina made a bowl game this year, I would have guessed no. And yet, lo and behold, there they were beating Jim Harbaugh on New Year's Day. So that's L number one. Michigan football is in shambles.
In my defense, I already rolled over on those guys months ago, so it didn't actually hurt that much. I was prepared for the giant collapse in the Outback Bowl. It was jarring to watch the college football playoff and see how football is supposed to be played
because haven't
seen it in a solid decade. It's amazing. They've got the forward pass. I don't know if you've heard about that. Michigan's still working on it. So I'm not going to go along with that one, but continue.
Okay, good. Well, I'm happy that you're weathering that storm. It sounds like you're doing okay. You're working through it. Number two, though, also from this weekend, Steph Curry came back. And look, we've had a number of arguments about who's better between Steph and KD. I'm not here to tell you how to feel. I just know that Steph came back Saturday night. He had about 70 points in 30 minutes. It was ridiculous. I think he hit 15 threes. And the Warriors looked like the Warriors again. And KD looks like a role player again. And it's clear to anyone who's paying attention that I was right all along about their relative value. So that's
Andrew, stop. Look, stop right there. We can't do this again. People are banging their heads against their windowsills, their mantles, their dinner tables. We can't call KD a role player. This guy is in the conversation as an MVP and a defensive player of the year candidate this season. He's been that good. Yes, the Warriors are built around Steph. Their offense always looks the most Warriors-esque when Steph is playing well and shooting well. But come on, it doesn't have to come at KD's expense. It's possible that both these guys are top three players in the league.
Yeah, they both are top three players. Steph is number two. Kevin Durant is number three. It's great. And moving on here down the list, we haven't really discussed this lately, But Ben Simmons, okay, the rookie who is too old for his grade and peaking in high school, he might as well be out there playing in a varsity jacket. He got off to a great start. He made you look really smart, made me look very dumb. But let's look at the past month. He is regressing hard whenever Joel Embiid is not out there on the court. And meanwhile, my guy Brandon Ingram is quietly progressing week by week. He's still younger than most rookies. He's looking like a legitimate building block for the Sixers. And Simmons could very well lose Rookie of the Year to Donovan Mitchell, another guy who I loved coming in the draft. Look, that is very Andrew, much a possibility now.
You're completely off the deep end on this one. I have some Embiid Simmons takes for later. I think we're going to discuss the Sixers at some point. I don't want to, you know, ruin your flow here because this is going so well for you, but keep going.
I'm just letting you know that's part of the perfect storm as well. We don't have to dwell on it too much. But there are two more. Number one, DeMar DeRozan, longtime nemesis of yours. For listeners who aren't familiar, one of Ben's annual traditions is stubbornly claiming that Chris Middleton is more valuable than DeMar DeRozan before every NBA season starts. And don't look now, but DeRozan is playing the most efficient basketball of his career. He had 50 on Monday to beat Chris Middleton and the Milwaukee Bucks. And again, it's just a direct assault on everything you hold dear as a basketball analyst. And I just, honestly, as a friend, I'm concerned for your welfare, but also as a rival, I won't lie. I'm taking some satisfaction in all of this.
Pure comedy. I've got about 15 minutes on DeRozan later, but keep going.
All right. Last but not least, probably most important, the toughest L that you've taken. You came on that podcast. The reason you said my world was crumbling is it was prelude to you making a 10-point case for the Houston Rockets as NBA elite. And I'm just going to let the listeners speak on this one, okay? So we had two questions come in. We had several Rockets takes come in, but we'll stick to these two. The first is from Greg. He says, I just wanted to check in to see if Ben is all right after that Celtics-Rockets game. Two of his strongest beliefs as a basketball analyst are love for James Harden and the Rockets and hatred for dumb plays. Watching Harden at the end of that game must have made his head explode. And then the second one is from Steve, who says, Andrew, I'm really excited to hear you talk about the Wizards beating the Rockets handily. It's like the basketball gods heard your cry to embarrass the Celtics, but actually did you one better in embarrassing Houston. So I'm going to let you have the floor now and let you respond as captain of the Rockets bandwagon here.
So I feel a little bit like Sean Spicer, where I'm in front of the podium and I've got questions coming at me from all sides and I want to answer all of them simultaneously. I want to do like six or seven rebuttals in the same moment, but I'm worried that if I start, you know, going back at DeRozan and the Rockets and the Simmons stuff all simultaneously, I might lose people. So let's turn this into the podcast of rebuttals, okay?
Okay,
let's start
fine.
With these Houston Rockets. First of all, yeah, really in shambles, okay? They lose five games out of their past 10, and oh my God, they've slipped to the third best record in the league. Oh, it's time to freak out. Meanwhile, your favorite team, the Oklahoma City Thunder, 12-17, riding a two-game losing streak. Now, couple yeah. things going on. Look, here with the Rockets.
No question, the Thunder would have made my list of Golliver L's if they hadn't
you
blown
wanted
that
them
game.
To.
Did they lose to the Mavericks the other night? It was bad. I forget who they lost to.
Yeah, it was tough. They lost a clutch game at home, bricking three-pointers to the Dallas Mavericks, and they continued their stream of complaints about the officials that has just been going on for like multiple months now. Guys, it's not the refs. I mean, they're making some mistakes here, but it's mostly you. Anyway, Houston. Injuries. They've had a couple. They're not in position to sustain them, just like the Thunder aren't. The key is when Harden was on the court, I mean, at least they're still competitive. At least their offense is still humming. At least they're looking like one of the top five teams in the league. when they're losing some of these complimentary guys. Now, with him going out, obviously all bets are off. Their season's in a tough spot for the next couple weeks. It's going to be time for Chris Paul to step forward, there's no doubt. But let me say, I do have a little concerns about that. I don't know if you saw the Lakers game. There's been a lot going on for the Rockets. First of all, Harden's meltdown against the Celtics was completely inexcusable. He went to his bad habits when times get tough, when the pressure mounted. We've seen that.
Can we talk about the Celtics for a second? Because that game, I think a lot of people honed in on the fouls, the two offensive fouls against Marcus Smart. And those were sort of borderline, particularly the first one. The second one was like clearly just Harden getting frustrated. But his decision making for like the entire fourth quarter of that game was just like he was on another planet. It was like he was playing at the Drew League, just pulling up from wherever, zero ball movement. I'm not sure like how does Mike D'Antoni like watch that and allow it to happen?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers say it's not the worst thing in the world. So, I mean, that's part of it. They were also up by like 25 points in that game. So, you know, he probably just thought he could, you know, put it away and take a shortcut. But what bothered me was a similar situation to their loss to the Thunder, which we talked about previously, where he reverts to his bad habits in pressure-packed moments. Against the Thunder, it was the pull-up and a contested three-pointer, is not moving the ball, like you're saying. It was also an issue against the Celtics. But the thing that really bothered me was his lack of game awareness and court awareness down the stretch. It wasn't just those two charges. I thought they were both flops, frankly, but whatever. It was how little he did to get himself open on the previous inbounding situation that forced him to kind of burn a timeout. And then also just how unwilling he was to work to get open on each of those two offensive fouls. You don't have to shove off. I mean, you can make a nice hard cut. You can have a plan. You can sort of be in the moment. And unfortunately, he sort of went to like glazed over James Harden mode, which we saw against the Spurs, you know, late in that playoff series. And that is absolutely a problem for them. There's no doubt about it. And everyone thinks I'm this big James Harden stan. I like him as a player. I've come around on him for sure. The guy is absolutely not flawless. There's no question. He's had a series of major late game mistakes over the course of his postseason career. Everyone understands that. What I'm saying is the average viewer will focus more on these mistakes late in games here during the course of the regular season rather than appreciating his giant body of work, which he's assembled over the last like 40 or 50 games. And frankly, it's not just about those late game mistakes. It's the foul stuff, too. I mean, everyone saw that kind of goofy thing where he got his arm linked with, you know, one of the Lakers players.
Yeah, I think it was Josh Hart. It was pretty bad.
Exactly. And so everyone will say, oh, Harden's just still up to the same old stuff. I mean, that happens every once in a while. But if you really sit down and watch Rockets games front to back over and over, you see a heck of a lot of impressive off the dribble plays, lots of nice ball movement, lots of incredible passes, huge scoring outbursts. And, you know, percentage wise, the nonsense, to me, it's a smaller percentage of the overall James Harden package.
Well,
so I still think he's kind of getting a bad rap here.
James Harden took, I think he either took 20 or 22 free throws in that Lakers game. So
he's really hard to guard, man. He deserves it.
I'm just saying, there's still plenty of nonsense. You came on the podcast like a month ago and told me that James Harden was a thing of the past and I needed to get with the times and watch the Rockets. Like the James Harden we've come to know and love over the last couple of years is still very much the same James Harden.
I disagree. I mean, in spurts, it happens. I understand that. But it's not representative of the overall package of what he's doing. It's just not. I mean, you take these little clips and they're easy to latch onto. It's just like why the Rockets were so upset when everyone was pulling his big defensive blunders. Like, yes, those are happening, but that's not representative of his overall impact on the play. Same thing with the goofy foul stuff. Like, you know, the Marcus Smart thing should not define his season. I mean, no one's remembering the previous part of that game where they're cruising up 25, 27, whatever. And I understand we should put those moments under the microscope because that's a bad sign for when they get into the postseason and they're going to have these tense contests with very disciplined teams like San Antonio and Golden State. He has to be better than that. And if he's not, we're going to crush him for it. And guess what? We crushed him for it last year in the playoffs. So,
yeah, look, my only point all along has been that it's not crazy to say, let's just wait and see what happens with Houston, because there have been enough red flags over the last few years to say that, like, we can't really gauge what this team is until we get to the playoffs. And that starts with Harden, because like there are real questions, and it's hard because I think especially over the last 5 or 6 years in the NBA, it's become very hot takey to question whether somebody is good in the clutch, because like by and large, a lot of that is kind of made up. But I think Harden has struggled enough in some of those moments to wonder whether it's in his head or something, or like there, I mean, he's certainly reliant on the officials, and refs tend to sort of swallow their whistle over the final 2 minutes. So that works against him. And I just think that, like, let's just wait and see with the Rockets. I don't want to read too much into it. They're still really, really good.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's don't set up this false dichotomy. It doesn't have to be, okay, they're going to fall apart in the playoffs because they've fallen apart before, when we can also say at the same time, that may happen, but this is also the best Rockets team potentially in franchise history. Harden, before the injury, was on track to be, you know, the MVP or, you know, one of the top two finishers. And their offense was sort of on pace to be one of the greatest of all times. And their point differential suggested they're one of the best teams of the last decade. Like, okay, which of those things is more compelling? You know, which approach is better, to just harp on these few seconds and get outraged and slander James Harden, or to take a look at the whole picture?
Don't tell me that I'm crazy for remaining a little bit skeptical as all this unfolds. I think
I'm skeptical too. I'm not telling you you're crazy for that. I'm blaming you for injuring him.
Fair enough. Let's go. Let's finish this off with a couple thoughts here, because I think Houston, there are a couple things, a couple conclusions after the last couple weeks that are sort of objectively true. I think number one, they really need to reduce Harden's minutes, because one of the reasons they started to struggle is that he didn't look entirely healthy. Like over the last couple of weeks, he's been less efficient, and that was, I think, a knee injury. He tweaked his knee a couple of weeks ago, and then he sort of played through it. And I think they want him to get the MVP, but if I were them, I would chill, because they showed over the first 2 months of the season that they can play without anybody, but they need Harden at 100%. And so like that, if that means playing him 30 minutes a game instead of 37 minutes a game, like that should be a no-brainer. And for some reason, they haven't gone that direction. Maybe that's why he's sitting out 2 weeks. And then the other two things that I noticed from watching them against the Wizards, and which, by the way, was absolutely delightful. When the Wizards make shots, they are awesome. And basically, when Otto Porter shows up, they're kind of unbeatable. But when watching them, the two things I would say is that I think Clint Capela is really, really important to helping them kind of diversify their offense. And Capela missed the Wizards game and the Celtics game, but they need him sort of as a threat on that pick and roll. Because he's also pretty good at kicking out now, too. And more generally, the one thing with Houston that has always been an issue is that when their plan A isn't working, they're not very good at finding a plan B. You know, like when they're kicking out to shooters and those shots aren't falling, they don't really have another way to beat teams.
So the Capela thing is true. You know, the other thing I'd say too, it's like they kind of miss Mbamute. That's not like a real sexy injury. You know, no one's really going to talk about that, but they're so strapped in terms of their rotation, where the drop off from any of those guys being out to, like, you know, calling up Gerald Green and his incredible haircut and trying to plug him in and, you know, get him up to speed on how you want to play in like a few days. I mean, that's a real drop off. But to me, another concern they've got late game, it's the Chris Paul factor, and he is sort of what you want as your backup plan that you're mentioning, and that's why they brought him in, so they have that diversity. But
right,
when Harden went out late in that Lakers game, and basically Chris Paul had to run the show through the overtimes, it was everything that people hate about Chris Paul boiled down into like a 10-minute period. I mean, he had multiple like blatant shove-offs so he could like take yeah, shots.
There was one shove-off in particular that was just ridiculous.
He was trash-talking Brandon Ingram at the free throw line for like 20 to 30 seconds straight, trying to get inside of his head. He was orchestrating people walking back in front and, you know, back and forth in front of Ingram during the free throws to try to throw him off. He at one point jumped in front of a guy who wasn't looking so he could get a foul call. I mean, he was doing all the little stuff that people get annoyed about. Mm-hmm. But the thing that scared me was the little incident with PJ Tucker. And I don't know if you saw that, but basically PJ Tucker had essentially a game sealing strip along the sideline. I think he ripped Kyle Kuzma and the ball went off Kuzma. Paul was worried there was going to be a video review, so he went like rushing over to retrieve the ball from the referee, and in the process of doing that, so they could inbound the ball more quickly and there wouldn't be a review, in the process of doing that, he like shoved PJ Tucker towards the baseline, basically to inbound it. Tucker gives him this look like, dude, what are you doing? And just shoves him right back. And that clip like went semi-viral, but what I didn't see people pick up on was a couple seconds later, Chris Paul gets fouled. They do the handshakes. Everybody shakes his hand except for PJ Tucker, who's just standing there, you know, in rebounding position, basically not even looking at Chris. So I don't want to blow this up and say, oh, the Rockets locker room is fracturing, blah, blah, blah. But Chris has the same situation as James late in playoff games when the pressure goes up, especially that Oklahoma series game that, you know, that will, you know, stand out to people. He goes to a different level of weirdness. He's wound too tight in those situations. He doesn't do exactly what needs to be done. Sometimes he goes too far doing the, you know, the cheeky thing. And that's another potential, you know, breaking point for this team. And they've got to stay together. Hopefully, you know, beating the Lakers was able to kind of mend some fences after that one. But the Harden injury is a huge hit, man. I don't think it's too much to say that that could be the difference, you know, depending on how long he misses, because it's 2 weeks minimum. It sounded like it was a fairly serious strain. I mean, this guy could lose the MVP over this injury.
Yeah, and look, there's no question that the Rockets are one of the three most fascinating teams in the league because, like you said, Chris Paul is definitely wound too tight in crunch time. James Harden is probably not wound tight enough in crunch time, and like we just have no idea how it's going to play out. But I'm not like seriously worried about their outlook this year. They'll probably still finish second in the West. I think losing Harden probably means that finishing first in the West is out of the question, but they'll still be fun, a fun wild card for the playoffs. And also
I wouldn't be surprised at all if San Antonio passed them by the end of the season. You know, it's that classic slow and steady wins the race Spurs approach. And they're going to look a lot different without James because, like you've been harping on, the minutes have been really high for him, but the usage has still been really high, and his impact numbers suggest that they're a different team when he's off the court, and there's no surprise to that, and everything's going to look different. It'll probably be similar to the feeling that you keep having with Steph when he's off the court in Golden State, and you're like, who are these guys? Well, you know, Houston doesn't have that like top two or three defensive level that they can go to compensate for Harden's injury. And so they're going to drop more games because of it.
Let's move on to another question here. And this one, we're going to go back to our favorite team, the Raptors. Trey says, hey guys, I'm sending this email again after DeRozan's 52 point game. And this is an email he sent a couple months ago, but, in brief, he says, my biggest problem with the top 100 list, although it was a great list, Ben and Rob got Middleton over DeRozan so wrong. That's like saying Avery Bradley is more valuable than a player like Bradley Beal. I understand what you're trying to say, valuing defense and efficiency, but it's a little ridiculous when you actually watch them play. So what say you, Ben?
Nope. Sorry, Trey. Well, first of all, let me say to the Raptors fans, you know, people were saying, I think actually you said I was condescending on the last episode towards them, kind of making fun of their local celebrity status. And frankly, DeRozan's big game had all the hallmarks of a local celebrity game. I mean, this guy finally makes five threes. You know, guys like Steph average five threes. For the first time in his life, he can finally hit five threes in a game. They've got a little paper holding up, oh, he scored 52 points. Congratulations. He's going on and on about the amazing feeling of the adrenaline and how he wishes he could bottle it up and, you know, relive this great moment. Look, if Harden had to write down the number of points he scored every single night, if he got to 50, he'd need a whole notebook of paper to get through all of them. But let me say this. The Raptors fans are the best thing about that franchise. I say this in a completely respectful way. They're like termites, man. They come out of the woodwork. There's no way you could fumigate them. They're always going to come back for more. I really, really respect and appreciate them for their loyalty and their dedication. But let me say this.
Okay.
They want this narrative about DeMar to happen so badly. They're pushing it so hard. And about him becoming this three-point shooter and becoming this all-around weapon and taking his game to the next level. And every once in a while, he follows the advice that we've laid out him for the last 5 years, and he's able to come through and do it. But it's not a night-to-night thing, Andrew. Like, look, we can't judge a head-to-head matchup like him versus Middleton on the basis of one game, right? Because on my best day, on your best day, you're better than Hemingway on his worst day. You know, if you're able to get 1,000 words onto a page, hold on. On your best day, you can get 1,000 words on a page. Meanwhile, Hemingway's worst day, he's drunk in a cabin in Cuba surrounded by like 35 or 40 or 50 cats, not getting any work done, okay?
Okay.
You have to look at the overall body of work. Now, all I've been hearing so far is DeMar, this amazing three-point shooter. I have a trivia question for you, okay?
What?
From like November 22nd through the next 28 days, so basically a month, how many three-pointers did DeMar DeRozan make this season for a month? A solid sample size of this player who's supposed to be this revolutionary three-point weapon for Toronto. How many total three-pointers did he make in a basically a four-week stretch? Do you know?
I will guess 30.
Andrew, the answer is one. He made one three-pointer over the course of a month. So that kind of proves my point. But that's what I'm saying. No, because here's why, though, and that's not your fault. It's because they want this thing to be true, because guess what? If DeRozan could really become this knockdown three-point guy who has that weapon in his toolbox every night, who shoots it confidently, it transforms their whole team. It takes him to where their fans think he actually is and not back in the pack where he really is in actuality. And here's the thing. He's shooting it more confidently for like the last week or two. Congratulations. But we have 10 years of evidence going back to when he was at the Nike Hoop Summit the first time I saw him that suggests he doesn't trust his shot. Go back and look at the tape from the playoffs. Not only did he not make three-pointers in last year's playoffs, he was afraid to shoot them. Late clock situations, he didn't want to put the ball up. There's no way around it. So if you're saying, do I trust the very best of DeRozan, his, you know, Hemingway day, or do I trust that much evidence and the spottiness that we've seen this year, I would say I'm still on the fence suggesting that he's probably going to revert to that spottiness. And
okay,
I think the one, and people are saying, oh, you got to apologize to him for this. Not at all. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing. We've said for years he should try to transform himself in this ways. And we haven't heard from one Raptors fan who's like, hey, you know what? Thanks. We appreciate you applying that kind of pressure because you were right. Who we have heard from is Dwayne Casey, who basically said, we've got to overhaul the offense. We've got to get these guys playing a more functional way. And he's right. And by the way, Lowry and DeRozan both deserve credit for acknowledging
they
that
do.
Their way wasn't going to work. So we don't have to say they're the top 10 players in the NBA now, but we do have to give them credit for looking in the mirror and saying, look, we're not as good as we think we are. Our way wasn't going to work in the postseason. And it remains to be seen whether their new way will work.
There are a lot of things that I enjoy about this tack of yours, because first of all, I think in your heart of hearts, you want to take credit for DeRozan's success this year. Like you're halfway
there. But it's not even
there.
Success, Andrew. If
you
want to
say
40%
that
three-point shooter,
he read the top 100 entry and adapted his game according to the prescriptions set forth by you and Mahoney. But you're not quite there. But I think deep down, that's what you believe.
Look, for years, this guy said, no, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to do it my way. And suddenly he comes around. Like, I don't know. I mean, he reached the right conclusion. No matter who inspired him to do it, hopefully it was Masai Ujiri. Hopefully it was Dwayne Casey. Hopefully it was the pain of all those ugly, embarrassing, pathetic postseason losses that got him on the right track or headed in the right track. But this guy is still not a three-point shooter. And if we go back to the original debate of him versus these other wings,
well,
in
see,
a postseason
that's the thing.
Format,
that's where you lose here, me. I agree that we should be patient and wait to see if DeRozan's style manifests in the playoffs. Because again, not to sound like a hater here, but it's basically the same discussion we had with Harden. Like, I just want to see him do it when it matters against elite defenses. But
okay, and here's my counter to that. He's also still a minus defender. Their defensive rating when he's on the court is 10 points worse than when he's off the court. The only guy worse, sort of from their major minutes players, is Jonas Valanciunas, exactly who you would expect. It's been that way for years. In terms of his on-off defensive impact, you listen to Casey's interviews. He's always harping on DeMar, hey, you got to get better on defense. And he's still doing that here within the last few weeks. So when we're looking at overall impact, guys who are going to be able to do it in the playoffs, if you don't trust his shot and he's a minus defender and you want to play at an elite level and have the ball in his hands for 20 shots a game, good luck. You know, there's a better way to play. We've seen it time and again.
DeRozan is really your perfect muse. You could talk for like 8 hours about his game and the pluses and minuses he's bringing to the table. I just think I've got to keep up with the termites.
I have to keep up with the termites because they come after me every single time.
You do hear about it way more often than anyone else. I think that DeRozan being ranked behind Middleton is insane. I would put him more in the low 20s range of the top 100. Like, I think Marc Gasol is the type of player who we have fawned over, and by we I mean like NBA Twitter over the last couple years, where DeRozan is about as valuable as Marc Gasol in terms of a building block and someone who guarantees that you're going to have a very good team, not necessarily a great team because there are other limits there, but a really good team. And that's where I think that there's a disconnect between the way I'm watching him and the way you and Rob are watching him. Like, I just don't think Middleton is more valuable than DeRozan if you're trying to build like a counterpoint to the Warriors and you have two other superstars, but it's not.
Yeah, that's what we're saying. I mean, we're not. Yeah. I mean, that's, we're talking who's valuable in the playoffs in that format. I mean, you were not making any pro DeRozan arguments in May.
Yeah.
I know, because we came back on the show. You didn't have anything to say, and neither did any of his supporters from May until now. And we certainly did not hear that from them at any point earlier in this season, other than maybe after that Philly game, which he played well.
Okay.
Two final thoughts here on DeRozan very quickly. First, he's averaging 25, 4, and 5. Middleton's at 25 and 5. Very similar steal block numbers. Middleton's not having the world's greatest season. He's playing too many minutes. They don't have as much help. And the statistical numbers aren't really that different. Certainly the branding or the perception of DeRozan as this amazing scorer is much higher than Middleton. But
will you concede that DeRozan has impressed you thus far?
He's been fine. I thought he was, frankly, as an individual player during the regular season, I thought he was better last year than this year. You know,
okay.
I mean, because the ball was in his hands more, he had to do more. The one bigger development from him has been trusting the pass and being willing to be a part of this offensive scheme where it's not sticking so much. His assist numbers are way up. That's a great thing. That needed to happen years ago, too. It's something that we harped on time and again as well. And I think he's sort of trending in the right direction when it comes to the three-point stuff, but I'm not convinced it's going to stay that way. And he doesn't take that many threes. And the volume from Middleton is like twice as high, the volume of DeRozan. And when you get into that playoff format where you need all the spacing you can get and teams are locking in on you, DeRozan's biggest strength is his individual scoring ability, that ability to get, you know, 50-plus points, which Middleton can't do. That evaporates in the playoffs, or at least it has traditionally against great defenses. Now, maybe he can do it in the first round. Congratulations.
All right.
But when you go deeper, it's going to go away.
All right. Well, this DeRozan discussion has gone on about 5 minutes longer than I wanted it to. So we'll move on. I think the listeners know that I was right about the Middleton argument, but you and I will never agree about it. So it's all good.
Well, let me ask you this. That was the game of DeRozan's life, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the best game he's ever played. They're at home in front of an amazing crowd, right? Milwaukee's
got
a terrible coach.
It's fairly routine for him to take over the offense down the stretch. So, like,
no, but that was the game of his life.
Much of an outlier. Like, he's done that before.
Okay, he's never scored 50-plus points with 5 three-pointers before, right?
Well,
my point is he's at home in front of a great crowd against a younger, a kind of overmatched team with a terrible head coach. They're more experienced. They've got all the advantages. He's playing the game of his life, and they still have to go to overtime to win it, and it's a nail biter. I mean, you tell me if that's the best moment of his life.
The Bucks are
the best game of his life.
The Bucks are a good team. All right. Meanwhile, your MVP from last year is like out there battling the Lakers to the final buzzer and going to OT just to survive in LA. So I don't know. It varies from night to night. But
well, that's why we don't harp on a one-game sample size to draw these comparisons, which is what the termites want to do. And I understand it. Have your moment. Look, We heard from all the Damian Lillard fans when he had 60-plus last year down the stretch about how he's better than Kyrie and he's better than some of these other point guards. And that's fine, you know, but let's also hear from you
okay,
when he goes
all right.
from 2 for 14 and, you know, you're getting frustrated. And let's also hear from you when you're calling him DeBrick or DeBrick Rosen or whatever they call him during the postseason up there, because they always turn on him. You know, they always get mad at him at some point.
All right.
I'm just saying fair and balanced, okay? That's all.
I 100% never called DeMar DeRozan DeBrick. I think that's a pretty horrible nickname.
No,
I like to
think Raptors
that I'm capable of better.
The Raptors fans, out of anger, or the Raptors observers, out of anger, you know, bring up silly nicknames like
okay.
that. I wasn't saying you did that.
All right. Well, let's move to the Sixers now. Because Ite says, a couple months ago, I tried to troll enemy of the process, Sharp, by asking Golliver to take a long advanced stat look at the Sixers' success. Today, I asked the same question again, but this time to understand what's gone wrong. So what do you think?
It's not an advanced stat. It starts Joel Embiid's minutes played. If Embiid plays 28 minutes or fewer this season, they are, I believe, 2 and 13,
wow.
something along those
That's
lines.
Incredible.
That's as clear as it gets. If he's on the court, they win games at, like, you know, a 70% clip. If he's off, they lose basically no matter what. And that absolutely factors into the perception of a guy like Ben Simmons. There's no question. You were almost right at one point of your opening monologue when you're saying that, oh, his season's falling apart because he doesn't have Embiid. Well, look at the drop-off when Embiid's not on the court. What is any one player supposed to do? What is a rookie supposed to do? It's massive. And when you're looking at overall impact and contributions, again, I understand why you want to get caught up in this Donovan Mitchell love fest. Come on, man. There's still a very large gap there. If Philly is going to make the playoffs, Embiid's got to be on the court. That's really as simple as that.
I think that there's a gap between Ben Simmons's ceiling and Donovan Mitchell's ceiling, but I think right now Donovan Mitchell might be more productive than Ben Simmons.
Because you love his volume scoring? And,
no.
And you don't value anything else about basketball? We don't need to have this same argument. I mean, come on.
I think for what the Sixers need, well, yeah, we don't need to have the same argument. I think there are two things to watch with the Sixers. That stat is incredible with Embiid. I hadn't seen that before. But I think the two biggest factors for the regression that we've seen are, number one, that first month where the Sixers really did look like they were going to be not only a playoff team, but like a factor in the playoffs and a scary team for anyone to match up with. Robert Covington was shooting the lights out and looked incredible. And it looked like he had turned a corner. And then they signed him to that deal, and it looked like the biggest steal in the NBA. And since then, his shooting has fallen off majorly, and he's sort of regressed to where he's always been, which is like mid-30s from three. And we'll have several games where he's like 4 of 12 or 3 of 13, and like that's just kind of like been his normal over the last few years, and that's coming back this year. And it comes at a time when a lot of these games, especially without Embiid, like they need someone to score. And then the second thing is, like, I just don't think we realize how ordinary this Sixers team is. Like, if you take Embiid off the court, they, like, Jared Bayless, JJ Redick, Amir Johnson, Rashawn Holmes, like, this could be one of the three worst teams in the league without Embiid there. And the only thing that sort of confuses people is Simmons. And after all the hype he got through that first month and how great he looked at various points, like they kind of think of him as like a tentpole star, but he's really not there yet. And so he makes the roster look better, but the roster is still pretty overmatched. Like really has no business making the playoffs when Embiid's not out there.
Yeah, they're not in a playoff team at all if Embiid's not out there. I mean, to me, Simmons without Embiid, it's sort of into that Devin Booker in Phoenix territory where it's like all the shambles around him are just too overwhelming. There's only so much one man can do, and he's young. He's still figuring it out.
Well, it's not only he's that. That team needs scoring, and that's the one thing that he really can't do. Like they need a go-to guy when Embiid's not there, and if you're running the offense through Simmons, like he's still fairly limited.
I mean, he's still averaging 16 points a game. I mean, come on. I mean, he's not that far off Donovan Mitchell, who you think is the second coming. Look, he's a significantly better playmaker than Donovan Mitchell. It's not even the same category.
Sure.
And Mitchell's a minus defender. So I think the gap there is still
That's
pretty
true.
Big.
Simmons' defense has been great.
I'm not here to blame anything on Robert Covington. I mean, we did talk about how the three-point shooting was going to regress to the mean. There's no question about it. He still is right there with Embiid in terms of like the on-off impact. His number's insane. If you take him off the court, they really, really get ugly. So, again, it speaks to their lack of depth outside of their, you know, maybe top four or top five guys.
Yeah. Yeah, their bench is pretty rough too.
You know, if we jump the gun on Philly as a playoff team, I'm not sure we should apologize for that because Embiid has been fairly healthy. He's been even a bigger impact guy than we could have expected coming into the season. If he maintains his current level of availability, I still think they're going to sneak into the playoffs with some other teams kind of coming back to earth.
Yeah.
And I think Simmons is more likely to avoid the rookie wall than a lot of other rookies because he's slightly older, as you love to point out. And also just physically, he's very strong and he's built for the pounding, you know? So to me, it's not panic time. In terms of just other statistical things, we mentioned this briefly recently. The turnovers are out of control. They have to figure it out, especially Embiid. He's got to get it down. He's got to make better decisions. Simmons, there's going to be a certain level of turnovers. But we're at the point with Embiid where even though he's missed so much time and he's still getting acclimated to game life and he's so assertive sort of at all moments in every way, both on and off the court, frankly, he's got to dial some of that stuff back because they do give away, you know, a large number of points every single night based solely on sloppiness.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one thing that we knew was going to be an issue coming into the season because they're just a really young team. And you're right about Embiid. Like, he has a lot of sloppy moments out there, but the Sixers are right on track for sort of what we expected coming in. And I should add, in fairness, despite my jokes about Ben Simmons peaking in high school, like the Donovan Mitchell, I believe is the same age as Simmons. So, he just stayed longer in college.
Yeah. Kuzma's old too. So there is a warping effect, which unfortunately brings us back to our most hated position, which is you really got to say a lot about what Jason Tatum's doing out there as a 19-year-old.
It is kind of crazy. And the Sixers, man, I'm not going to apologize for buying into them after through that first month. Because when they're good and when everybody's healthy, they are scary. And particularly when Covington is making shots. I know you don't want to like overplay that too much, but that he really is sort of the X factor when I watch them. Because
that's how it should be, though, right? I mean, you have your stars in place, and then you live or die with guys like Redick and Covington making their threes. Then your offense is clicking and you're smacking teams. I mean, that's what it should look like.
Yeah. All right. Next question here. Nick says, as I was watching the Wizards in DC, I was thinking about which NBA team has the most depressed crowds. I mean, the Wizards crowd is probably top three depressing. The Hornets and Suns are up there as well. So which are the most depressing crowds to you guys? So I mentioned this on the last podcast that the Wizards were probably like bottom half of the league in terms of a live experience. And then Spike Eskin from the Rights to Ricky Sanchez followed up and was like, they're definitely bottom three. And then we've got Nick here putting them bottom three. I really don't think that they are. I think that everyone is sort of underrating how dark some of these experiences are around the league. I'll leave it to you first to say, like, who are your most depressing crowds?
I mean, Washington definitely comes to mind quickly, and not just
because really?
I'm mocking you. Yeah, I mean, it's just always so flat, and they're not really cheering when they should be. And outside of that one John Wall jump on the billboard moment.
Playoff games are different, man. Playoff games in DC are completely fine.
I think Detroit is probably the most depressing. I mean, it's worse than going to the dentist, and a lot of people, I mean, I love the excuse. Anytime they're making the excuse, everyone's just standing on the concourse, having a great time. That's when you know that you have a terrible arena environment. Mm-hmm. Look, anything I say to this is going to come off snobby. I mean, to me, the Blazers have had one of the best home environments over the last like 10, 15 years. It's probably slipped here the last couple of years. Fans are kind of checking out on this current team. But Blazers fans have literally nothing else to do in their lives besides, you know, get to the game early and scream like crazy for 3 hours. And so I kind of, you know, Phoenix, I mean, a lot of these are Washington, Detroit, Denver, the Pelicans, the Clippers when Blake is injured.
Oh, man, the Clippers is a really good one. I missed that.
Yeah, I mean, Orlando at times. I mean, it's kind of fan-friendly there. It's sort of like the Anaheim Angels games. Like, they're just waiting for rally monkeys to show up, you know, but it's not necessarily, like, the real intense crowd. I mean, Atlanta had to put a bar into their stadium.
Yeah, the Atlanta bar is always kind of sad when I see that pop up on League Pass. Yeah, you're right, though. This is a tough spot for us because, really, no matter what we say, we're going to come off like assholes and possibly alienate listeners. But I will say, as I was defending the Wizards experience, I came up with a list of 10, most of which you have mentioned. But Hornets, probably worse. I've never been to a game in Charlotte, but I'm just assuming. Suns, Nets, Pistons, Pelicans, Magic. I think the Nuggets are the one like quasi good team that is probably worse than the Wizards. And then the Hawks, the Kings, the Wolves are another good team that a lot of times.
No. Don't put the Kings in there though. Their fans are pretty
really?
Legit. Yeah, okay. They're surprised. I mean, there's for how much they've gone through.
That's true.
They are surprisingly resilient and they really get behind their guys. I mean, they'll go nuts for like Garrett Temple. It's just great.
Yeah, okay. Well, fair enough. We don't have to dwell too much. I'm just saying that the Wizards are probably not one of the three most depressing live experiences in the league. The Nets is one where, like, it should be more fun. Every time I've been to Barclays, it's like seems like a cool experience, and then the energy is just drained from the opening tip. But maybe it's different this year. Part of it is the way they light the court in Brooklyn. I'm not super into that. Although the Nets have been more fun, maybe more people are on the bandwagon. So who knows? But
One thing I'd say to keep Charlotte in this discussion, remember Purple Shirt Guy from a few years ago?
Yep.
So you know it's bad when one fan is able to be singled out as like the worst person in the world because he's the only one kind of yelling and screaming at players during games. Like if you're at a good arena like Boston or Portland or some of these other teams that we've mentioned, you can't just hear one guy's voice, right? Like Dwayne Wade's going back and forth with that guy because he was the only person that he could hear from the crowd during a playoff game. That's a bad sign. So if you're able to identify one guy as being an overtop fan, that's a, you know, it's a negative indicator.
It's a red flag.
And likewise, I mean, and I've said this before, but the cheering for fried chicken, you know, during the fourth quarter of a playoff game from the Wizards fans and like having that be the best moment where everyone's so excited to get free food.
Oh, yeah.
It's always, always a gigantic red flag.
Look, I maintain that the Wizards are not the only fan base that has that happen, but certainly we've somehow become the most famous fan base that goes nuts for free chicken, so it's fine. I'll live with that.
It's fine during the regular season. You can't be doing that during playoff games because it just shows how unmotivated the fans are at other points of the game.
Yeah, and at other points in the season. I'm cool with it. I grew up in this world of apathy, and I inhabit it freely and without complaint. So next question from Corey. He says, I now see why Boogie and AD won't work together, and it's because they each need to be the guy. I'm not sure which teams are anti-Boogie, but I think trading him to the Bucks for Chris Middleton and Thon Maker maybe, or maybe a trade with the Heat for Hassan Whiteside, both of those could be good options. I don't know. I'm a Pelicans fan, and I've spent way too much time on the trade machine this year. So...
Well, I like that he has come around to the idea of trading Boogie. I mean, that's progress for sure. I think there's a tendency for a lot of fans when you trade for a big name star like that to just defend that guy forever.
Yeah.
Especially when you're on this short timeline, getting out in front of that, I think shows a remarkable foresight by Corey.
Well, I just wanted to read this because I think Boogie with the Bucks would be a fascinating fit and have him
play.
You think so?
Yeah, horrible.
Why?
Well, first of all, you're trading my guy Chris Middleton, so I'm out already. I'd rather have Chris Middleton than Boogie in that situation. They need an interior defender, and that's not DeMarcus Cousins. And they need to make sure the ball's in Giannis's hands, and that's not DeMarcus Cousins.
Why can't Giannis be the interior defender?
He can for, you know, stretches of the postseason, but these guys should be a lot better than they are. They need a big look. I mean, what happens when they go against Embiid in future playoff series? Do they have an answer? You know, you've got to have the ability to protect Giannis a little bit and then downshift to that smaller lineup. That's how I would do it.
That's the interesting thing with Boogie, though, is I think that night to night, he's going to be generally pretty awful on defense, but if there were a big moment in a playoff series, I would bet on Boogie to defend someone like Embiid. And that's part of the reason I think he's worth the risk in some of these trades. And I like the Bucks idea in part because sending Middleton to New Orleans would give New Orleans a little hope and allow them to sort of extend this Anthony Davis era a little bit longer and see what they can make happen. Whiteside, it would be fun to get him out of Miami because I like watching the Heat more when Whiteside's not on the floor. And I also think that, like, if there's one place, if Boogie can't make it in Miami, he's not going to make it anywhere. So it would be fun to sort of send him down there and see what happens. But I just don't think that's going to happen for whatever reason. I don't think the Pelicans bringing in Whiteside would be that attractive to Anthony Davis. And that basically just sort of jumpstarts the rebuild.
Well, I like Corey's foresight in terms of moving Boogie. I don't really agree with the premise of his question. I don't think Boogie should be the guy. I think the best situation for him is where
that's a good point.
He admits to himself, like a lot of these other stars have had to admit to themselves, that his way is not good enough to get over the hump. He can't even make the playoffs yet at this point playing his way, and he's better off taking a smaller offensive role and committing himself, you know, more energy to the defense. And, you know, frankly, maybe he just doesn't have that defensive ceiling, but I would like to see him try really hard, surrounded by, you know, other players who are committed and playing together. I think that's the best environment for him. If you just throw him, you know, on a team like Miami and say, "Hey, you're the star again. Here, go do it," you're going to get the exact same results you've gotten both in Sacramento and New Orleans, where it's like, you know, ultimately, you know, huge stats but very unsatisfying. You know, popcorn numbers, empty calories.
Yeah. Fair enough. That's part of why putting him with Giannis would be pretty interesting. But I'm not really advocating for the Bucks to do that. I just think it would be kind of a wild experiment. Moving on, though.
They wouldn't have to fire Kidd. He'd just leave. I mean, there's no way.
That would be a good way to force Kidd out the door. Cameron had a quick question about the draft. He said, "Why are NBA teams so intent on drafting just off of potential and what a player could be? How do NBA teams decide between proven skill versus potential?" So to me, the answer there is pretty simple. Like, the value of hitting on a high upside pick is a lot more valuable than like a solid rotation guy. Whereas I think lower in the draft, especially the last few years, you've been able to pick out guys like Josh Hart, for instance, in LA, looks really solid. And you can get those guys in the late 20s and early 30s. But if you're in the top half of the draft, you might as well just sort of swing for the fences.
Yeah, it's a simple answer, and you basically said it. You have to have superstars to win. If you don't have top 10 players in the NBA, you don't stand a chance. The best way to get them is to use the benefits of the contract setup, knowing that if you draft a guy in the lottery, you're going to have him potentially for 7, 8, or 9 years. That's why you go for potential and hope that you can kind of, you know, mold it into one of those superstar level players. And that's as simple as it gets. Obviously, young players are going to be farther away from their peak than guys who are a couple years older. You know, it's very common to do what, you know, you and I have done here, is geek out about these, you know, 21, 22 year old players coming in as rookies and then overlooking the guys who are maybe 19 or 20. Who in two years could be, you know, more productive and higher ceiling type players. So I think that should answer Cameron's question.
Speaking of that, though, next year's draft is beginning to look pretty wild. I was kind of ready for a down year after last year's draft was so loaded, but there are 6 or 7 guys. Mo Bamba, I watched the entire TCU Oklahoma game last weekend, and it was awesome. Trae Young is incredible. I can't tell, like, what's going to translate with him to the NBA. I'm a little bit skeptical because it seems too good to be true, but he's been amazing. So
yeah, let me ask you this. When is somebody going to write the Trae Young should just go number one?
When does that come out? We're getting there. I think he started the year ranked like in the 30s on draft lists, and he just keeps putting up these ridiculous numbers and kind of getting whatever he wants. He's very crafty and good at drawing fouls. And I don't know, man. Like, it's one of those things. Like, I kind of need to follow up with, like, actual scouts to see what they have to say, because I watch him and I'm just like, holy shit. Like, just put him on an NBA team and let's see what happens. Because I mean, he's hitting from like 35 feet out. And if you could do that off the dribble, like, you're going to be a star. It's pretty simple.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not arguing that he should be the number one pick. I wouldn't consider myself an expert at this point of the season on who I would take. But when you look at the off the dribble shooting, you look at the range, you look at the confidence, you look at the instant impact as a very young player on that level, you look at his overall, you know, package in terms of being able to create a shot, volume scoring, playmaking for others, and we know the value of, you know, guards who can do those things in the NBA. Everything is sort of built around them. I'm just surprised no one has gone all in on that. I guess that's my point. And maybe what I'm really doing is encouraging some draft analysts.
Are you encouraging stick me your, to do it?
You know, somebody, yeah, stick your neck out, Sharp. Let's maybe. See it. Let's do it.
I'm not sure if I'm there yet, but all right. One more question before the podium here. So this is something that we were discussing over text messages in our group chat yesterday. But if you could play for any coach in the NBA, who would you choose, Ben?
Greg Popovich. Look, I don't need buddy buddy. I need someone to mold me into the best version of myself that I can be. I think he is the highest IQ coach in the NBA. I think he's the most experienced. I think he's the most proven. I think he's the most consistent. No nonsense, tells you the truth. But you know, he also, I think, has that soft touch side behind closed doors that guys really respect and appreciate. I don't see any other answer, but I know you've got some other silly answer, and so that's why we have to debate it.
Let me ask you, though. You don't worry about Popovich sometimes repressing what you do well? Because to me, like, I think Pop over the last 4 or 5 years has taken on this kind of like grandfatherly persona around the NBA, and he's like Captain Progressive, and I love everything he says about politics, and it's great. But like, I do think that playing for him would be a little bit more miserable than some people realize. Like, he kind of demands conformity as a rule. And I just think that like his public persona is not totally accurate. And like, if I were a player, I would not want to play for Popovich.
Yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me that you're a little bit afraid of being of a part of something that's bigger than just yourself. You know, it's a natural fear that people would have. But I think at the end of your career, do you want to be Jamal Crawford or do you want to be Manu Ginobili? You know, do you want to have been part of
all-time greatest teams? Maybe Jamal Crawford.
I know. I understand, and you know, that's obviously why you're wrong. I mean, do you want to be a part of? You want to be a Hall of Famer? Do you want to be a guy who is part of some of the greatest teams of all time? Do you want to have set the standard for how second units should operate? Do you want to have lifelong, lasting friendships with a coach and mentor and teammates who are going to be your brothers
know.
Forever?
There are a lot of guys who don't have lifelong, lasting friendships with Popovich. Like, I don't know how often Popovich is talking to Steven Jackson these days. You know what I mean? Like, Jackson
don't,
has
expressed... Don't let him down.
I guess so.
You got to live up to his standard. I mean, what are you going to say? And actually, I think if you gave Steven Jackson truth serum and let him do it all over again, knowing what he knows now, my hope would be that he realized that Pop probably got more out of him than any other coach along the way.
Your hope for Steven Jackson. Yeah, I guess so. Look, so... When we were arguing about this over the weekend, you asked who would you want to play for as a basketball player and who would you want to have coach you in life? And for me, the answers are different. As a basketball player, I would want to go to Miami and play for Eric Spoelstra because I think he's great at getting, like, he would get me in shape, number one. He gets the most out of his players and highlights what they do best without that Popovich tick of like eliminating some of the individual flair. Like, I mean, Waiters is allowed to be Dion Waiters down there and they still win with him. And that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's working so great for them.
Right. Yeah. Look, it's not working that well. I'm not going to lie to you here, but Spo would be awesome if I were playing. And I think there are other players who get the most out of their guys, or other coaches who get the most out of their guys, who then get the lion's share of credit. Like even Jason Tatum this year, who's been awesome, half the conversations about him are how the Celtics have optimized him in ways that would not have happened anywhere else, which is like a little bit true, but probably not giving him enough credit. And then in life, though, I think the only answer for me is Steve Kerr, because he would just be the best life coach. He would know exactly when to push, exactly when to sort of lay off and give me the support I need. And he just seems like someone who's like incredibly good at being a successful, nice person.
Yeah, you're kind of the Nick Young of podcasters. I could see you fitting right in with
exactly,
Steve Kerr.
Exactly. If it works for Nick Young and JaVale, I could make it work with Steve Kerr.
Okay. There's no way to knock Steve Kerr. I mean, I think the culture that they've created is remarkable. I was reading Jack McCallum's book a couple of days ago, you know, the Jerry West book, where he's talking about the Lakers' old culture in the 70s and,
yeah,
you know, comparing it to the current Warriors. And right from the start, he rewinds to like draft night with Steph Curry, where he's brought onto a team where the coach, you know, doesn't really prioritize him, where he's getting frozen out by his teammates, where Monta Ellis is basically telling people in the media, look, we can't play together, and, you know, just openly saying that. And just everything has flipped 180 degrees for this franchise. And Kerr has probably gotten a lot of credit for that, but he deserves every single drop of it. And what he pulled out of Curry has been unbelievable. What he's pulled out of Durant has been really, really impressive too. I mean, there were years where I spent wondering what would it look like if Durant really committed defensively, if they played him up a position, if he fully put all of his physical tools together. And there was that one situation, you know, when the Thunder played the Warriors in the playoffs, where him and Ibaka really cranked it up, and it was like, wow, it's like they have two Ibakas now, like Durant's everywhere. Why did it take so long for that to come out? And then, you know, contrast that in Golden State, where it's just they're consistently night in and night out. Again, a lot of the credit there goes to the coaching staff, knowing what buttons to push, knowing how to make players comfortable, knowing how to kind of coax guys out of their bad habits towards better habits, and, you know, goal setting and all these, you know, really, you know, nerdy things that we like to talk about in the media, they matter. And it's come out, there's no question about it, for the Warriors. At the same time, who did Kerr learn from? Greg Popovich. So, checkmate.
Yeah, I guess so. I really have enjoyed Kerr, especially this year. Part of me wonders when I watch him in interviews and listen to him, like, I wonder whether he's planning on leaving at some point. I have no inside information, but like just sort of listening to him, he reminds me of like late term Obama, where he's just letting takes fly left and right and is completely at peace with himself. And it's been super enjoyable as a fan. But I wonder if maybe he knows, like, all right, this is the final run for me, and then I'm going to step aside. He's just sort of enjoying it.
I have a different take. I think it's a change in the media from the last 10 years, the way that NBA players and personalities and coaches handle themselves. There used to be a lot more reticence, not wanting to hurt feelings, not wanting to, you know, create controversies. And I think what people have realized here, especially, you know, since November 2016, is the news cycle moves so fast, no matter who you are, no matter what you say, that there's really no point to reticence. Like, if you have takes that you want, you'll feel better expressing them publicly, then go ahead and say them. The repercussions, as long as you're not being incredibly offensive to like minority groups or something along those lines, they're not going to stick. I mean, people aren't going to look down on you for that. They'll actually appreciate your candor and your honesty. And so, yeah, I think for people who view themselves as leaders in society, like Steve Kerr definitely does, like Craig Popovich definitely do, they feel an obligation now to talk, to express themselves in a way where they probably didn't, you know, 10 years ago in quite the same way, or they see less value in picking and choosing battles and more value in just straight shooting. And I think that's a necessary antidote in this political climate.
Yeah,
and
that's,
I think,
fair.
He came out and told USA Today something similar last week. And, you know, to me, it never really bothered me when people spoke their mind 10 years ago. But the fact that everyone does it now, and it's a more united thing.
Yeah, that's true. It happens so often that it's less of a story. And you're right that if you ask Steve Kerr, that's exactly what he would say. It's just like, yep, this is part of my responsibility as a leader. And it's been very cool. There's one other dark horse in this conversation that I thought of just before we went on to record today. Luke Walton would be a pretty fun coach to both play for and have him coach your life. Like, I think he has sort of perfected the formula to living a happy and successful life.
He's definitely happy. I kind of wonder about some of his players because we're seeing these reports about the Lakers having locker room meetings. Julius Randle would not agree
with that take.
Yeah, and you are a little Julius Randle-like too. I mean, that same category. I wonder. I do think Walton's still figuring that balance out. And yeah. I think he was so much more comfortable when he had the veteran guys who were just bought in and all in when he was coaching the Warriors when Kerr was out. A younger team is a totally, you know, different animal. And you know, that's one thing about, you know, analyzing Kerr too as a coach. I think there's a fair question to ask. Would his style work in every environment around the NBA? You know, I think the conditions were right. The players were right. He came in at the right time to get the most out of his approach. But like, if you throw him on the Suns, you know, what does that look like? And it's another reason why I would stand out for Popovich. He had all sorts of help, Duncan, Robinson, you know, amazing talents, but that culture has sustained and has grown, and it's been built on a team in the Spurs who, you know, prior to his arrival were not on that, you know, super elite level. And I think if you dropped Popovich on basically any you know, roster 20 years ago, he would have them being perennial playoff team regardless of the talent on hand.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Walton definitely had an easier time coaching the Warriors than the Lakers, where like I see Lakers fans get angsty with Walton every few weeks, and like I don't know, man, they have 10 like maybe good players in LA, as it sort of varies night to night who shows up, and so it's a pretty tough spot that Walton is in. I think he's done a good job getting them to compete defensively, and they've been able to hang with pretty good teams every night. But so to me, like, he's been a success, but like asking him to do much more than that with the roster that he has, where everybody's like 21 or 22 and might turn the corner or might sort of level off and as like a rotation piece off the bench, is really tough.
Yeah, I don't envy like 27 of the coaches around the league, to be honest. I mean, maybe 25. I think the guys who really have it made at this point are the ones with organizations who truly have their back, whether it's, you know, Spoelstra, Carlisle, Stevens, Kerr, Popovich. I feel like everyone else, they have a really, really, really tough job, and they're probably not paid enough to do it.
Okay, well, let's skip the podium this week. We've already gone too long, but last question then. Who's the coach that you wouldn't want to play for?
Let me think. You go first. Let me marinate on this.
Okay, so I think I was going to say Tom Thibodeau, which is kind of the easy, obvious answer. But then you mentioned Rick Carlisle, and playing for off-brand Popovich in Dallas and losing 50 games a year and having him bark out orders and be completely joyless the whole time would drive me fucking insane. And like, it would be bordering on like a Carlissimo Latrell Sprewell situation. And so I think he's top of my list for guys that would just be an absolute deal breaker for me.
Yeah, you really have a problem with Carlisle. What's up with that? I mean, dig into this a little bit.
It's not like a personal thing. He just, like, there's something about him. Like, Pop at least has a little bit of humor to him, whereas Carlisle is just constantly grinding and is never really, like, he's just doesn't seem capable of like empathy and human emotion, and it's like he's driven off good players in the past, and he just sort of like, something about him irks me. I can't really explain it.
Okay, this is going to be a controversial answer to your question. And I think it actually might surprise you. My answer is Mike D'Antoni of the Houston Rockets.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, I'm going to try to take the high road here a little bit and not clown on some of these teams that aren't quite as good with coaches who are probably in over their heads. I mean, the real coach I would not want to play for is an interim coach, any interim coach. I mean, what's the point? Substitute teacher lifestyle. What are you going to learn from that guy? He's coaching for his job. He's not empowered. Is he going to be about the right things in terms of, you know, trying to make you a better player and ensure that you're in a position to succeed? Probably not. And that's the worst possible situation to me. Which, by the way, again, it goes back to that terrible decision by the Grizzlies to do what they did earlier this season. However, my problem with Mike D'Antoni is the stubbornness and the willingness to trust his system over everything else. And I think that's sort of where we would, you know, butt heads, because you have to be willing to adapt and evolve and improve. And you mentioned it earlier about like what's their backup plan. And I think, you know, D'Antoni had some comments recently of like, we're not really worried about matchups. We're just going to do what we do and let the chips fall, essentially was, you know, his statement in terms of how the Rockets go out there and play. And I can never imagine Greg Popovich or Steve Kerr or Brad Stevens ever thinking that way.
Yeah.
And I think that mentality absolutely is going to be one of the defining characteristics of him, his career as a coach, if he winds up retiring without ever winning a title. Because people will look back and say, look, this guy was too stubborn. He was too single-minded. He was too trusting in what made him a success to be willing to listen to other ideas. And that might be, you know, a little bit unfair to him. It might be a little surface level. I'm sure he's shown some evolution over the years, and certainly his offenses continue to get better. But the questions about their late game stuff, all, you know, it all goes back to D'Antoni. Well, I mean, what do they do if the three-pointers dry up? What do they do if Harden is having an off night? You know, what do they do if they, you know, go against a huge team in San Antonio who's kind of able to beat them playing big? What do they do if they play a team that's better at offense than they are, like Golden State? I just don't see quite enough willingness to adapt and be flexible. And I think ultimately, as a player, I would feel like I'm going out there and kind of fighting a lost cause. You know, it's like, why do I have to run up this mountain?
But hold on, because you would have inflated stats under D'Antoni. You would,
yeah,
like,
well,
the sets are relatively
simple. Do I care about
simple.
That or not? Come on.
I guess you don't. I guess you don't. But I mean, he's an affable guy. He's an intelligent guy. He's worldly. He'd have a lot of great stories for you from his heyday in Italy. Like, I don't know. I think you're being a little too hard on D'Antoni. Like, working with him on a daily basis would be pretty great. But
I'm trying to win, Andrew.
I guess so. One day there will be a really interesting piece to be written about Mike D'Antoni and Tom Thibodeau, because I do think that they're sort of opposite sides of the same coin, where they're both innovators, but they also like almost innovated like 5 or 6 years too early and before either one of them had control of their own team. And by the time that they did, the rest of the league had sort of caught up to what they had revolutionized. But I don't know. That's a separate story, separate discussion.
I'll grant your points about the personal happiness. There's no question. Although he has had kind of a long track record of teams that weren't really that happy with him.
Well, if you're Carmelo,
or each other,
you're not going to be super thrilled to play the four for D'Antoni, which is really Carmelo's issue.
I mean, can you see you and me in the Lakers locker room posing like Kobe and Dwight, pretending to punch each other with D'Antoni laughing
Maybe.
In the background? I mean, yeah. God, that was so ridiculous. But I just think, you know, it's not completely rings or bust in my mind, but you want to feel like you're playing for absolute greatness. I think that's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
You know, I want to be maximizing everything. And, you know, the questions that you raised to start this podcast aren't going anywhere. I mean, to bring this full circle, and he is a major reason why. We can point to Harden, we can point to Chris Paul, but it's D'Antoni's philosophy.
Look, man, you're pointing a lot of fingers on this podcast. After your Rockets crashed back to earth, you blamed me for the Harden injury. You blamed you're now blaming D'Antoni. You're blaming Chris Paul. I don't know, man. I think you kind of just have to own this. We can revisit it on Friday.
Well, look, on a closing note, one more shot at the Raptors to just send this
no,
home.
No, I'm not going to let you do that.
On the last podcast, I mentioned that I thought Detroit had made something like 4 straight Eastern Conference Finals. That's why they were so much better than the Raptors. You know, back in that Chauncey Billups era.
Uh-huh.
I need to fact check myself on this. They actually made 6 straight conference finals during that era, which is remarkable. People don't talk about that nearly enough. I mean, they were sort of like a halfway dynasty there for 6 years. So the gap between where our favorite team Toronto is and where our emailer's comparison point, the Detroit Pistons, were, is even wider than I could have possibly imagined. That was my fault. I will apologize for making that one error, but everything else on this podcast and other podcasts has been thoroughly fact-checked and is 100% accurate.
Well, good. Way to double down and ensure that we will be Canada's least favorite NBA podcast for a second straight year. Thanks, though. This has been fun. We'll be back on Friday. We've got Isaiah Thomas returning this week. He's going to Boston Wednesday night. I am psyched. And it's that we're recording this on a Tuesday afternoon. He's debuting against the Blazers tonight. It's going to be awesome. Anyways, we'll be back with that. Lots more email from you guys on Friday. And hit us up and leave a review, unless you're from Canada, in which case, please don't. And Ben, this has been fun. We'll check in later in the week.
5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, openfloormail@gmail.com for all of your questions, all of your Lego sets, all of your termite removal strategies, all of your Instagram questions. We've been getting a lot of those lately, Andrew. Ben.Golliver on Instagram, openfloormail@gmail.com. I'll talk to you.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.